St. Thomas Aquinas Seminary Revisited. Only, gratefully, not because of the necessities of war, not yet anyway, but out of a kind invitation from His Excellency and the gracious hospitality of one and all. I am very, very happy to be back. A chance to escape from the mad world for a few days and come and spend some time hiding out here. And while I'm taking a little respite from the insanity that is plaguing the outside world at the present time, I hope I can use this opportunity to do all of you a bit of good. For a number of years, some of you that have been here for a while have asked when I was going to do a conference on Brideshead Revisited. And it was inevitable. It was bound to happen, as I love the book deeply. It is one of... I tell people that I have three works of literature that I have to reread regularly, just on a regular basis, and I rotate them, simply out of a profound love and because they keep me going. And one is King Lear, and the other is Don Quixote, which I'm lucky enough to be teaching right now to my plebes at the Naval Academy. And the third is Brideshead Revisited. I just keep reading those things over and over and over again, and they sustain me. But it also means I have a deep love for them. But unlike Lear and Quixote, I haven't often taught Brideshead in public. I have used it as an apologetic. It's the work I have handed out to more young men at the Naval Academy than any other work. When I see a glimmer in the eye that there might be a hope of bringing them into the fullness of God's truth, this is the first book I give them. And what I have found over the years is that it works the way a great apologetic should, and yet we don't often think of a novel as a work of apologetics. And yet I have found that to be the case. And as God in His infinite mercy has brought a number of these young souls into the church, one of the means He has used has been this remarkable book, this extraordinary book. So I'm delighted to be here. And a measure of my love for it is the number of conferences that I'm giving on it. And I suspect I will still have the problem that I always have of running out of time, but nevertheless. So I'm very happy to be here, and the weather cooperated. Traveling to me as I grow older becomes increasingly a burden. I know they say that travel broadens the mind, and I don't want mine broadened much more, thank you. I prefer to close it, as long as it's closing on something real and true. Although you do see things as you travel. Two things just this afternoon driving down. One, an extraordinary thing that I'm still pondering. I passed out here on the highway coming into Winona, a gigantic tanker truck. Huge tanker truck. And as I drove by it, on the side of the truck it said, Grease Services. And I realized this was a tanker truck filled with grease. And I was wondering, was it hair oil? Were they taking it to McDonald's for their French fries? I'm still pondering what a tanker truck. It's one of those that you hope never turns over on the road. What could they do? You know, heat it up and we could all stop and cook at it. I don't know. The other one that was, and I really, whoever's responsible here, I would like to have you be brave enough to stand up and take credit. I saw the giant signpost at the bottom of the hill, women priests, whoever shelled out to have that put up. It's an extraordinary way of conveying an idiotic message. So you just never know what you're going to encounter when you head out into the world. And in fact, true to form, I have readjusted my first talk tonight as a result of two things that have happened in the last week. I was going to cover this subject briefly, but I'm afraid I can't do it briefly. I can't do anything briefly anymore. But two things happen, and I'll mention them in reverse order. I'll get to the first one at the end of the talk. The second one happened just this morning. I was visiting, I arrived late last night in Minneapolis and stayed with my brother and sister-in-law and the two children, my nephew and my niece, and my little niece is 3 and a half. And she was bringing books to me this morning to be read to. And I have wonderful memories from my own childhood of, it's a favorite children's book of mine, which is A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh. And I also have memories of reading it to my brother, who is some years younger than I am. And when he was quite young, I read the Pooh stories to him. So being a traditionalist, I thought now would be a chance to read the Pooh stories to his daughter. So they had them on the shelf, and I went and pulled them off and opened one of my favorites, which is Piglet Meets the Heffalump, and began reading to her and realized that she could not concentrate. And she's a bright little girl. It wasn't that she was 3 and a half, but the problem was the very simple, black and white, beautiful shepherd illustrations. And the book is mainly text with some very small black and white illustrations. And it wasn't possible because she couldn't listen to what was being said because there wasn't enough to engage the eye. So I finally realized it was pointless and we stopped. And then she asked her mother if she could put in a Disney video. And it was a little sing-along thing, and I thought, well, it's standard. This is what happens. But the first song on the Disney video was a Winnie the Pooh song. Now, there is a world of difference between the Disney Pooh and the A.A. Milne Pooh. What Disney did, and it's I view it as a tragedy, he got the rights to all the Milne books. That's not Disney. Disney's long gone. It's the vultures who now own Disney Enterprises. They got the rights to the Milne books. They have the right to use the characters. They redrew them. And if you want a sense of what's happened to children's literature, look at the beautiful shepherd drawings and then look what the Disney studios have now done to Pooh. Saggy, sentimentalized, overdrawn. It's awful, absolutely awful, as are the stories. And indeed, the little story that was on this little video was something about sharing and caring and that sort of crap, you know. It wasn't... It had absolutely nothing to do with any of the original stories, and of course nothing that rose to the artistic excellence of Piglet Meets the Heffalump, which is a perfectly ordered and lovely structured little children's story. Well, what happened is it sparked my thoughts along paths that they've been taking repeatedly for some time. And what I want to do is spend the conference tonight speaking about the disaster that has happened in language and narrative and its replacement by image and visceral incident. And I'm going to be covering two different areas. One, the difference between word and image, and the other, between narrative and thrill. And they are not the same things. The two are closely interrelated, obviously, but they are quite honestly worlds apart. Now let me start, because I think it is important that you understand what I'm grounding this in, with a definition of how I view the language I'm going to be using. I am a teacher of English, and that means that words matter to me, and I love words. And the reason I got into my profession was because I have a love of language. I'm lucky enough to be paid to teach Shakespeare. I hope they don't find out. I've always had a sense that I'm putting something over on someone, and that they give me a paycheck and let me go in and talk about Shakespeare. It's not a bad way to make a living. But I'm fortunate enough to deal with the greatest writer the English language has ever known, a master of language who used it with precision, beauty, depth, and genuine spiritual insight. And therefore, once I became a Catholic, it was very clear to me that what I dealt with out in the world and was lucky enough to deal with in poetry and great fiction and drama and the teaching of it and trying to educate young people to be more adept and more aware of what language is and how it can be used takes us back, of course, to the opening of the Gospel of John. I think that chapter one of that gospel is certainly one, maybe my very favorite passage in all of Scripture. And one of the joys of going to the Tridentine Mass is I get to have it there as part of the liturgy every Sunday. It's magnificent. But nothing you don't know, but here it is. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him. And without Him was made nothing that was made. In Him was life. And the life was the light of men. I'm just going to turn that around a bit, reverse the definition, and say what Scripture teaches us, what the opening of the Gospel of John teaches us, is that the light of men is the life of the Word. Now, it's capital W. Obviously, it's a reference. It's reference to our Lord, the second person of the Holy Trinity. But there is a sense in that what I'm going to talk about tonight is that language is an extraordinary gift from God. And when we talk about words, small w, we are in some sense, or we should always in some sense, have in our minds that eternal perfect Word, the second person of the Holy Trinity, the Son of God made incarnate, who came to us, and by being with us, brought His salvation to us. I want to counter that with an Old Testament passage, because this is the contrast that I wish to make. I'm in Exodus chapter 20, again, not anything you don't know, but I'm setting this in opposition to the opening of John. Thou shalt not make to thyself a graven thing, nor the likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath, nor of those things that are in the waters under the earth, nor shalt thou adore them, nor serve them. If the Word came to us and brought salvation, we have a strict warning to avoid graven images, and to especially to avoid the propensity to worship those graven images. Now, we know what happened at about that same time is that indeed the Israelites begin worshiping that graven image of the golden calf. There, we have the example, if you will, of how easy it is to fall into that. Now, we say and we think of it, well, we're not capable of doing that. We would not do anything like that, although obviously we live in a society, in a world, in a time that does worship wealth, that values the material, that places the material above things spiritual. It's simply where we are, and we acknowledge that. But what I'm going to claim tonight is there's something even more insidious going on, and that the moving image, the image captured on the screen, can also in one sense be viewed as a graven image, and we live in a world that is coming to worship that, and that that is finally demonic and destructive, and we have been ordered not to do it. Now, in saying that, I've got to start by making a public confession. This is, you know, it's the sort of thing that usually happens at evangelical revival meetings. So I promise you I won't weep and embarrass you, and I won't throw myself on the ground. But since I remember a time years ago being here and saying this in public, I now must retract it. And that has to do with the fact a question came up about the uses of the television set. And I made the statement that the television set itself as an instrument, simply a technological creation, is of not necessarily in itself morally wrong. It is the uses to which it is put, and that it can, on occasion, have a good use. I'm taking 99.99% of that back. Maybe it's just age and crotchetiness. I suspect it is increased experience in the world, but I'm now here to say, throw it out. Or better yet, as I know a couple of people have done, take it out in the driveway and shoot it. So no one else can have access to it and pick it up and carry it off. And the reason I'm saying that is I'm beginning to understand the insidious nature of it. But I'm throwing in a number of other things. As a man who was raised on movies and TV, and they shaped much of who I am, I'm now seeing the new uses to which they are being put. And it has to do precisely along this line. There are major changes going on. There are things happening. And the images that are flashed on those screens are doing work that is positively destructive in a profound way, touching the spiritual nature of man that I can, in a way that I can only call demonic. And I am increasingly troubled by it. Now, let me go back to the beginning and draw this distinction again and then begin following it through, because I'm making a claim that language is an extraordinary gift that we have been given by God. It is part of what makes us fully human. In fact, if we go back to the Greeks and take the notion that that we get from Aristotle, that man is the rational animal, that what sets us apart, what raises us above the animals, is that we have the ability to reason, then it is very clear that we cannot reason minus language. Language is necessary in order for man to be a rational creature. And it is a special gift that has been given to man. Although most of my students would claim that the porpoises can talk and gorillas can talk. And indeed, it's a sign of how far this insanity has gone that I cannot bring up this subject in a classroom without having the rest of that class devoted to defending the proposition I just made that language is unique to man. They will fight it tooth and nail, and you cannot now get beyond it. It is impossible to go beyond it in a public classroom or a public arena, because for years this propaganda has come down that the porpoises are squeaking to each other and the gorillas are talking to each other and the chimpanzees can push the right button and get their banana. And no amount of reason will dissuade them of this fact. But what we know is that language is special, and it is one of the things that defines man. We can take it beyond that to reason, yes, but also the language is there so that we can pray, so that we can communicate. I would say so that we can create things of beauty, poetry. There are a number of different uses for it. But perhaps, first and most importantly, I defer to St. Paul, who tells us faith comes by hearing. And if faith comes by hearing, then we need language to tell each other the great truths of that faith. There is no other way that faith can be communicated or understood. Of course, it could be infused into us, but we need that language in order to comprehend it. We are dependent on that language to give it to others. And obviously, as Catholics, we understand the power, the importance, the glorious uses to which language can be put every time we participate in one of the sacraments of the Church. For the form of those sacraments depends on language. And just to take the most obvious, those words said by the priest in the person of Christ at the altar, "This is my body," does something stupendous. And we know the words are necessary to effect that sacrament. As a sinner out in the world, I'm very grateful for the words that my confessor can say to me at the end of my confession that will free me from those sins. The words are necessary to do that. I know the case of a midshipman of mine who had converted, who went to see the chaplain at the Naval Academy, made an appointment to go to confession, and was asked when he arrived at the chaplain's office, what's your problem? And he said, well, I don't have a problem. I just want to go to confession. Do you need counseling? No, I don't need counseling. I just want to make my confession. Are there troubles out in your life? No, there aren't troubles, but I've done things I shouldn't do, and I want to go to confession. And he was on a schedule. He had to get to class a little later, so he finally said, I just knelt down in front of the priest and started making my confession. He was taken aback that I'd gotten off the chair during the face-to-face, the counseling session, and suddenly was just running through, as he said, the laundry list of my sins, at the end of which the priest said, well, do you feel better now? And the midshipman had to say, well, if you'll absolve me, Father. All right. This is what we've come to. And it is not accidental that with the shift in the sacraments in the Novus Ordo Church has come messing with the language. And I won't get into right now the whole debate about many and all, but the fact of the matter is these things matter. Words are hugely important, and as Catholics, we know that. Those words are part of those sacraments. Those sacraments come to us from Christ, the Word incarnate. These things are connected. What happens to a world that begins to lose language? And it's happening out there. It is a simple fact that what is happening is that language is deteriorating, vocabularies are shrinking, people are less and less able to express themselves linguistically or have a pool of words to draw on to describe what they think, what they feel, and as a result, they are often impelled or compelled to a kind of action because they are blocked in their very nature. I don't know the fact of this, but I do suspect it has something to do with the increased level of violence that's out there in the world. We cannot give anyone a good tongue lashing anymore because the words aren't available to us. We've got to act physically because that's what we know and what we've seen, and I'll come to that in just a moment. The sad fact that language itself is collapsing into obscenity as well. It is everywhere in public now. The sense that certain words are inappropriate at certain times has been lost. And one reason for that is that the young, sadly, pathetically, are more and more becoming repositories for filthy language without even knowing that limited vocabulary that they are carrying around with them is inappropriate. It's absolutely shocking. I remember when I was teaching in Philadelphia one day, teaching out at one of the suburban campuses of Temple University, and I took the subway and then the bus to get out to where I was going, and it seemed like I only heard one word, an obscenity, over and wherever I went. It was incredible. It was like all other words had been forgotten, and just this one word was being repeated by everybody in verb form, noun form, adjectival form, adverbial form. It was as if there was no, you know, it was sort of if these people had printed their own dictionary, it only would have had one word in it that sufficed for absolutely everything. And of course, that word, an obscenity that should not be used in public at all. I don't think this is accidental. I think this is part of the reductive nature of this sick world that we're living in which the words are being taken away. Now, I'm going to do this very briefly, but I think it's hugely important. Many of you know of the Catholic novelist Walker Percy. Wrote some very interesting novels. I'm very fond of them. I'm teaching The Moviegoer to my plebes later this semester and just rereading that again and very impressed with it. Well, Percy had another side. He was very interested in linguistic theory as well. And he promoted an American philosopher by the name of Charles Peirce. It's spelled P-E-I-R-C-E, but pronounced Peirce, who came up with a very interesting theory of language and launched in his way a study called semiotics, or the theory of signs and symbols, and the way in which signs and symbols are used, and it connects with language. I'm going to do this very quickly just to make a point, but I think you'll see where I'm going. If you'd like to talk about it some other time, I'm very happy to. Charles Peirce made the point that if you look at the way in which we know things in the world and respond to things in the world, almost everything is what he calls dyadic. And by that, he simply means two-ness. One thing leading to a second thing. You can think of this in a couple of different ways. I'll just put here, A leads to B. A leads to B. Cause leads to effect. Okay? Cause leads to effect. Action leads to response. And that, in fact, what we know of the world in terms of nature, is learned that way. When science goes out, and the proper study of science is nature, to tell us what's out there in the world. When science goes exploring and wants to know why suddenly a particular tree is dying, Dutch elm disease. All the elm trees began dying in the Midwest back in the 60s, I think it was. Maybe it was earlier. Something was wrong. Why were the trees dying? And what they went exploring. What they found was this little beetle that had gotten inside the tree and was killing the tree. And at that point, they had made the discovery that beetle was killing the tree. Reason the tree was dying, beetle killing the tree. You can see it with children. You say to the child, don't touch the stove, it's hot. And of course, the kid immediately walks over to the stove and puts his hand on the stove. That's okay. That's perverse fallen human nature, even in the little ones, okay? The immediate, and the hand is withdrawn, and then, you know. What has happened? We have the action and instantaneously a response. Action, response, cause, effect. That's how things work in the world, in the world of nature. But what Peirce came to comprehend was that there was something that was very mysterious that happened with human beings when they talked to each other. That doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. It doesn't happen in nature. And it's this. He claims that language is triadic. It doesn't work A to B. It can't work A to B. It works A to B by means of C. Okay? Let me explain this. I have decided that I want you to go to the store and buy one of those little round yellow citrus fruits that make your lips pucker when you bite into it, okay? I could do anything on earth to try to convey that to you. I could hold my hands a certain way. I could pucker my lips, okay? I could try to look yellow. I don't know, okay? But ultimately, I'm going to fail, and you would just think I should be institutionalized because there is no earthly way I can get from A to B. That's me wanting that little yellow citric fruit to you going to the store and buying it. I cannot get there minus this particular jump where I take these weird sounds, L, E, M, O, N, and put them together and say, L, E, M, O, N. Okay? And at that point, having put those squiggles in that order and assigned those sounds to it, oh, you want me to buy a lemon? Sure. And suddenly we have understanding back and forth. But it's only possible via the third, that third part. That is the sign, the symbol. Try this one. I go mad and I assume dictatorial powers here in the seminary. And I say, I'm going to blow the place up unless tomorrow morning when I get up on the table, on a table outside my room is this. Okay? Wait, wrong way. I want that. Okay? Now, you can stare at it for a while. Some of you will be puzzled. You realize it's an emergency. He's really finally flipped out. He means it. We discover he brought dynamite in his car, gasoline, he's got the wiring, and he's going to blow the place up unless this is on the table outside his room tomorrow morning. Now, this becomes absolutely dependent on someone being able to look at this and know what it means. Anybody here know what this is? Chleb? You're doomed, okay? You're doomed. This is a Russian word. If I put it in a series of equally bizarre symbols that you do understand, you're going to have no problem and you can save the place. That's what it is. B-R-A-A-D. It's bread. Easy enough to do. Oh, quick, go up to the kitchen. Give them some bread. But you cannot do it unless you recognize the series of symbols and signs. Let me take that. Remember the little round yellow citric fruit? Let's do this to it. I have taken the same series of five squiggles, okay? Tell me what that is. Absolutely nothing. An omoi. Tell me why those five squiggles in this order mean nothing, and the five squiggles in this order are perfectly comprehensible to you. Why should that be? It is an agreed upon understanding, but it is dependent on mutual knowledge. So that when I say lemon, you know what I mean, and you're able to do it, unless I say used car, and they take on an entirely new meaning. Okay? And suddenly this is transformed into not this little yellow citric object, but a really junky piece of a mechanical thing that I used to drive around in. Okay? How did we get from one meaning to the other meaning with the same set? My point is this. I will not pursue it any further. This is mysterious. This is absolutely mysterious. And the point that Peirce makes is this needs to be studied because it's unique, and it's unique to man. The porpoises can't do it. They cannot say, Hey, Joe, I think there's a tuna net over there. You probably don't want to swim over there. You're going to get stuck in the tuna net. You're going to be called in the boat. Before you know it, you're going to be in a star-kissed can. They cannot do that. They are incapable of doing that. But we can. We can. And we can do it on a number of different levels, whether it be, if you're going to the store, will you pick up a lemon for me? Two, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Two, this is my body. And suddenly, language becomes that which defines us in all sorts of mysterious ways. It is not accidental that in this age that is losing its humanness, we are losing our language, our ability to use words. Walker Percy, in one of his essays where he is examining this, points to the young American girl named Helen Keller, who was born blind, deaf, and dumb. Some of you may know the story. There's a play written about her called The Miracle Worker, film made too. It's of real interest. But he makes the point that until the moment the breakthrough came, she was an animal. And we know this of children who are raised either outside of human influence or in that unfortunate circumstance where they cannot hear language and get to know it. They cannot take in that world of symbols and signs, that extraordinary moment when the child says its first word, sitting on daddy's lap, and suddenly Bowser walks by and the kid says, dog! And it's, oh, Jimmy said his first word! Okay. Well, it seems silly, but at that moment, something mysterious has happened. The child has made that connection, that those sounds connect with that animal. And if I say that to daddy, he's going to know what I mean. That is a very mysterious process. But it has to do with the mystery of language and its threeness. rather than its tunis, okay? So young Helen Keller couldn't do that. She was an animal. She was an animal. The family couldn't control her. They bring in a teacher, Annie Sullivan, to work with her, to try to do something with her. And Annie Sullivan, who had problems herself in terms of vision, begins trying to teach the little girl through language that is the printing of letters in her hand, so that whatever they did, you pick up a book and Annie Sullivan would spell B-O-O-K in the little girl's hand. If they were going down the stairs, she would put her hand on the wood and say S-T-A-I-R, nothing. We're at the table, pick up a fork, put it in her hand, F-O-R-K, nothing. This went on for months, but she never stopped. And then one day they go out to the pump to get water. And we pick up the pail, P-A-I-L. We go down, we feel the pump, P-U-M-P. It's just routine now, matter of fact. We pump and put our hands under the water and spell W-A-T-E-R. And suddenly, little girl feels the water, grabs her teacher's hand, and repeats W-A-T-E-R. That connection had been made. And then it was feeling a tree, T-R-E-E. Okay? And suddenly the whole world opened up to her. She became human. She became human. Because suddenly she was able to know, identify, use the signs in order to gain knowledge of what was around her. She, if you will, became human by acquiring language. Now, let me back up. If everything we do is dependent on this, then there is a serious problem when language breaks down. Whether it's the ability to say, go to the store and buy me a lemon, create beautiful poems, speak to someone else, preach to someone else, okay? Discuss ideas with someone else. How do you spread the faith when language has been destroyed or emptied of meaning? You know, when the time came and things were beginning to be written down, Plato puts in the mouth of Socrates a sense of some misgiving that the fact that things were going to be written down was not necessarily a good thing. It meant that there might be less discussion and that memory might go. We no longer need to remember. And we know for a fact, and I see it now in my students, we have gone from, you know, the time when the bards would walk around Greece reciting the entire Iliad. Look at the Iliad sometime. Imagine trying to memorize it. But that's what they did. To the point now where memory is so short, almost nothing can be retained. I find it's very difficult for my students to retain anything. There's a wonderful line near the end of Bride's Head where Lord Marchmain is talking about the time when the house was taken apart and moved up the hill, the time when the old farmers had long memories. It's a deliberate moment in the book. It is an earlier time when things were remembered. And what was remembered first and foremost, important events. Shakespeare and Henry V's Agincourt, the speech before the Battle of Agincourt. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot. But he'll remember with advantage the deeds he did this day, okay? Some things won't be forgotten. The Battle of Agincourt will not be forgotten. The fact that our Lord walked in the world and taught will not be forgotten. These things will be passed on. These things will be remembered. Will be remembered. And it's language that becomes the carrier. So, you know, Plato was uneasy even with writing. Gutenberg begins printing and suddenly books are available. And that old Protestant attack. I heard it when I was growing up. Catholics were not allowed to read the Bible. Okay, is of course utter nonsense. But there is the sense, and it's of some interest, that what many of us view as the peak of civilization in the Middle Ages, at the time of Aquinas, at the time of Dante, books weren't readily available. People didn't have books. A few did. And in the greatest age of faith, there wasn't a Bible in every home. What was needed to be known was known. It was gotten across. It was communicated. And the church, Mother Church in her wisdom, was able to provide what was necessary. Printing comes, boom, the books go out. And look what happens. Okay? Within 500 years, nobody cares to read, or if they do, they're reading junk. Absolute junk. It's what I mentioned a year ago, the sad story. Those great works that were forbidden to be read in the Soviet Union under the communists, the barriers fall and suddenly they become readily available and nobody reads them. This is the mystery, okay? There is the availability of books does not mean an increase in knowledge in any way. But then what happens? Then the word, and here we go, then the word goes on the air. And suddenly, we're told, think of the great wonders that radio can do. Taking things out to everyone, and everyone can hear it. And what has entered the picture is electricity. I'm not going to take the time to go into that, but if you do not know the magnificent essay by Solange Hertz on electricity, I recommend that you read it. Fascinating, thought-provoking, in her book called Utopia, Nowhere, Now Here. It's an absolutely fascinating essay. But electricity comes in and suddenly words are available in every home broadcast from coast to coast. And the process began of the loss of language. I'm making the point that the more available it became, curiously, the less we tend to pay attention to it, the more we take it for granted, and thus it can be taken away. And at the same time, in come the movies. And by this time, by the time of radio, we've got movies, we've got photography, in which the image is asserting itself. Up until that point, yes, there was painting, there was sculpture. In the great medieval cathedrals, there was stained glass, and those stained glass, indeed, those were all, in a sense, images, but notice what they were doing. Illustrations in support of the stories being told, so that those who were hearing them could be aided, in a sense. And there is a difference between staring at a medieval painting of a Madonna and child over time, and what the image has come to be today. Okay, and this is what I'm moving toward. It is not the same thing by any means. The movies come in, photography comes in, and now suddenly we're in a world in which communication is not happening via language anymore. Over the past few decades, we now know via image. We now know because of movies, TV, and computers. Screens with flashing images on them, to the point where places where there is no logic for substituting a word, we suddenly get an image. I'm lucky enough to live close enough to work so I can walk back and forth. It's only about a 10-minute walk. I'm lucky enough, I'm one of the few men left in the world who can walk home for lunch, which is a great blessing, although not necessarily, but nevertheless. But walking back, and then I noticed one year, I can't tell you exactly when, the walk, don't walk signs were gone. And suddenly, when I wasn't supposed to walk, there was this hand like this. And when I was supposed to walk, there was this bizarre figure going... And it took me a while to figure out what that was. And I felt, oh, that's an outline of a pedestrian, I guess, okay? And no longer, just very simple. What, now, do you remember when traffic signs were changed? You know, there used to be words on the, now there are pictures on all the traffic signs. This isn't accidental. It is part of the reinforcing of the fact that language doesn't matter. What matters is the picture, is the image. And the image is working on us in a very particular way. I'm not going to go into an extended discussion of what the movies themselves are. I grew up on them. I still have a profound attachment to them. But the fact of the matter is, they're weird. And I also love the theater. And the first weirdness is, anybody who's done theater knows that the excitement of theater is live actors, live audience, interacting. Theater is live. No two performances are ever the same. Because there is this back and forth energy between the performers and those who are watching the performance. Not in the movies. You could play that movie, whatever it is. You could take The Wizard of Oz and have it played to a theater full of five-year-olds who are loving it and squealing and cheering and laughing, or an empty theater with nobody in it other than the people picking up the empty popcorn and washing down the floor, and it doesn't matter. There's no change in the performance because life is gone. What have we got? Flickering images on a screen. There is no connection whatsoever. And beyond that, there is the terrible, the very mysterious fact that we're looking at images that were captured, and I'll keep it going, in 1939, then arranged, clipped together to amuse us. And by the way, I love The Wizard of Oz, okay? I wouldn't miss for anything hearing Bert Lahr sing If I Only Had to Noive or If I Were King of the Forest. I love it. It's wonderful fun. But the fact of the matter is there's something weird going on there, and the weirdness has to do that I'm looking at flickering images on a screen, and now it's even weirder because I'm watching the dead. Judy Garland, dead. Bert Lahr, dead. Ray Bolger, dead. Jack Haley, dead. Margaret Hamilton, dead. I'm watching all of these people trapped in time back when, who appear to be living and before me. And this is an image, and my response to it is somehow not right. And we know about the raising of images. Go back and read 1 Kings chapter 28, the witch of Endor. Saul going to have the image of Samuel raised before him. That is wrong, and we know it. In Acts, Simon Magus, the magician of some serious, who viewed the miracles the apostles were performing as magic. And then the legends that accumulate around him in later years of him raising up images in Rome and pretending to power. When we find images in Scripture or people raising images or seeming to raise the dead, it is those who are somehow acting against God's law, and there is something very suspect or very wrong about it. And yet that's how for decades we have amused ourselves. In the same way that we don't now pray for the dead, we capture them on photographs and hang them on the wall. Oh, that's Aunt Sophie. Gee, she was wonderful. Look at her there. We had such fun that day. And look at that hat she was wearing. And wasn't it great? And nobody's remembering to pray for her because it's as if we've captured her and she's there still with us. It's mysterious and not necessarily good. If the movies are quite literally now, through flickering images, raising the dead, then they are omnipotent because only our Lord could raise the dead. Only those who are allowed by God may raise the dead, and the movies are claiming a kind of omnipotence.